Go ahead and get started here. My name is Zachary Loafman. I work for a company called Isilon Systems. Today, I just wanted to give you an overview of the SMB1 and SMB2 protocols. They're the primary file sharing protocols on Windows. I wanted to give this to you from a BSD or more Unix perspective and try to explain why you should care. So at Isilon, for those of you who didn't see my talk yesterday, we produce a scale-out clustered storage. It's a FreeBSD-based clustered storage solution. But Windows interoperability is actually very core to our survival. People deploy us both to replace Windows servers or to replace Unix servers or both in some cases. It's not just core to us, though. It's actually core to basically anyone who really wants to rip Windows out of their shop. You really want to understand what SMB is and why some of the existing solutions are not sufficient. A lot of Unix people are under the impression that Samba solves just about everything. In some cases, it's okay. But there are a lot of interop issues with existing solutions right now. It really also depends on what kernel you're running Samba on top of and a variety of other things. I'm not going to get into actual setup details here. I'm just going to discuss the various interop issues, give you an overview of the protocol, and go from there. The other reason you might care is that NFSv4 is heavily influenced by Samba. SMB, sorry. In a way, NFSv4 and a lot of the NTFS imitation features are similar to someone who went off and saw Greek architecture, you know, traveled months back to their homeland and tried to imitate it. But that is not to say that that Microsoft produced a glorious work. It's just to say that there are a lot of interesting changes along the way from various implementations. So, overview of SMB. I'm going to dive into SMB1 first. Then I'm going to talk about what SMB2 changed. And then I'm going to give you a lot more detail on various interop issues with SMB itself. As I said, SMB is the primary file sharing protocol in Windows. It has been the primary file sharing protocol stretching back to Windows for Workgroups. It even made a brief appearance in certain DOS versions. Because of this, the intellectual property on the SMB1 protocol is very mixed. IBM actually created part of it, and there's a whole mess of IP associated with it. You might have heard the term SIFS a while ago. In fact, I will accidentally use the term SIFS to mean SMB. Microsoft uses the term SIFS only now to describe the portion of SMB prior to the Windows 2000 extensions. They do this for legal reasons. The DOJ final judgment in the US, it covers SIFS, but it doesn't cover anything past that. So they've kind of encapsulated the pre-Windows 2000 portion as SIFS. I will variably refer to the original SMB protocol as SMB or SMB1, and SMB2 didn't appear until Vista. Thanks to a recent EU action, different than the DOJ final judgment, Microsoft has been forced to document the client-to-server protocols, not just SMB, but almost all of the client-to-server protocols, thoroughly. Initially, they were only required to share it with an open-source front company that Samba created, but Microsoft realized that the ease in which you could join this open-source front company was too low, and they just said, hell with it and open it up on MSDN. The caveat is if you do go off to MSDN, you won't really see it very prominently, but there are little claims mentioning that, oh, by the way, we might have patent claims on these protocols. In practice, the patent claims are mainly irrelevant. If you implement something just to interoperate with SMB, you're not going to infringe their patent. If you were to implement something like SMB, you might. The PDFs are actually very useful. Microsoft, because they are forced to document them very thoroughly, there's actually a separate review organization that essentially gets a blank check from Microsoft every year, and whose job is to sit there working through the protocol docs, implement what's in the doc, and verify that what's in the doc matches what's in their server. Because of that, the documents are actually much more thorough than even like an RFC on protocol would be. RFCs on protocols are notorious for leaving out nitty-gritty details. And generally, you refer to the reference implementations to figure out the details. In this case, you have to know the details. So if you ever want to go peruse these, they're fairly good. Microsoft has also done a good job of replying to protocol documentation errors, and there's actually a public mailing list for it now. Different than NFS v3 and v2, SMB is a stateful file access protocol. It was originally designed to run over NetBUI. Remember those days? And NetBIOS. As of Win 2000, it runs on TCP directly. Almost all Windows clients since Windows 2000 will prefer SMB over TCP first and then try the port 139 NetBIOS solution. That's not strictly true. A lot of times Windows clients will just send out both and then whichever answers first, it'll go. As of Vista and beyond, it waits a brief second, or like, you know, several milliseconds before it actually bothers to try the NetBIOS solution. One caveat there is plenty of non-Windows clients, like the OS X client, for instance, still use NetBIOS. Each SMB connection or session is authenticated, and I'll show some snippets of the beginning of it. Again, as of Windows 2000, it is a Kerberos best effort. That best effort has actually been increasing as you get closer to Vista. They've been able to use Kerberos in more and more scenarios. There are plenty of scenarios where they still can't use Kerberos. An easy example is you're sitting at a Windows desktop and you browse to WAC and then give an IP address. There's no FQDN in that case. It just doesn't work. So they fall back to an authentication mechanism called NTLM if that fails. They're fairly different, but they both work in their different ways. Newer clients actually prefer NTLM v2, which is a much safer than NTLM v1, which is known for having just brute force attacks against it. Within a session, a client may then connect to multiple trees, but a given session is only valid for a given user. On most Windows servers, this is irrelevant because unless you're running something like terminal services, you only have one user. If you're running something like terminal services on our multi-user system, you will have multiple connections from that system to the server. SMB also gets used in a weird way as a transport for Windows-named pipes. So I'll show a snippet of this later, too. You'll actually see it just open a IPC dollar, and then it'll go and talk to a named pipe. It then uses DC-RPC to communicate over the named pipe. Because of this, almost all services in Windows are actually just programmed to DC-RPC and are then available remotely because their common IPC mechanisms just use DC-RPC as well. One of the best ways to understand SMB is just to take kind of glance at the NTFS or the NT file access protocols and imagine just shoving that over the wire. So it has kind of the Windows security model, a heavy NTFS influence, and because of it, as the API is gradually involved, SMB1 has a cumbersome number of commands. It is basically insane. Most clients actually only send a small subset, and as the years have gone on, the clients have dropped to, I want to say that Vista might send close to upper teens, and that's about all you'll ever see from a Vista client. This is the SMB1 command set. Now, keep in mind that like NFS has, again, upper teens, RPCs. I cheated on some of these. The ones that are all marked trans 2 are actually subcommands under one command, but in effect, they're just single commands. But still, that gives you an idea of the difficulty of trying to implement a fully compliant SMB server. So I'm going to fly through these pretty quickly because they're not terribly interesting, but this is little screenshots of me in Wireshark taking, browsing to a server, picking a share, and then browsing that directory. The first couple packets are just this negotiate protocol. There's a dialect request in here. Ever since, I think, Win95 or so, it's been NTLM 0.12. As of Vista slash 2K8, you may see a dialect in an SMB1 packet that says, hey, I speak SMB2. So the SMB2 negotiation actually consists of sending an SMB1 packet to offer either, and then the server may reply in SMB2. That session setup and X request response, because it's going through NTLM, it's actually this four-way nonsense. It'll send a negotiate, there's a challenge back, and then I send my data, and then I get a okay. You can see my little desktop slash whack Z Loafman there. I don't have an example for the Kerberos one. Like I said, the first thing I did was actually just browse to the server. When you browse to a Windows server, it actually has to go off to a special service called Serve Service to list the shares. So of those 100 and some odd commands, there's no command to list the shares. You have to go to a separate name pipe and deal with the DCRPC chatter. So here's an example of a name pipe. It does this ntcreate and x, which is the equivalent of an open command, off to a pipe called serve service, and then it does a DCRPC bind on it. From there, it gets a little, well, from there, that last serve service request is Wireshark translating a DCRPC request for the serve service to do a share enumeration. So, okay, now I'm just opening the share that I found and querying it. This is a tree connect. Trees in SMB are like mount points almost. This is a directory enumeration. One of the things I forgot to include on the slides, but is in the Wireshark, you might notice, is directory enumeration in SMB actually takes a blob or a glob. So in this case, it's enumerating slash star, but you're allowed to enumerate any DOS style wildcard, which is painful on the server side as well. So that's kind of the whirlwind overview for SMB1, and then I'll get into some nitty-gritty details in a second. SMB1 and SMB2 are pretty fundamentally similar, but they took and essentially cleaned up the entire protocol and rewrote it from the ground up. I wish I had a copy of someone else's slide. I couldn't find it before this, where they took that giant map of commands and they just bolded the commands that were imported into SMB2. But essentially, they took the giant list and pared it down to this much smaller command set. And believe it or not, none of these, with the exception of something like a query info, which has a variety of what Windows calls info levels, none of these are even compound, like none of these actually have a subcommand associated with it. So this is much more a kind of an NFS style, let's try to reduce the command set and keep things down to what we think we need approach. It got cut off on the bottom. There's a write down here. It's right below read. I forgot to, I was formatting this and didn't notice it went over. Yeah, it's also a read-only command set. No. The other thing that SMB2 added and is a significant step forward for SMB is the addition of durable file handles. This is very much NFS style. You do have to request a durable file handle, and they have some special properties associated with them. But it means that SMB2 failover is now possible. Even SMB2 failover is possible even though the protocol itself is stateful. SMB2 was also made entirely handle-based after the initial create call. One of the things I didn't exactly show in the SMB packet captures was that the almost all of the commands you do even after the open, well, almost all the namespace commands are completely path-based. SMB2 changes it a bit, so you open things and then do the operation you want on it. So create tends to be the only thing that you see paths on, except for something like a rename to, which actually looks like a create. You get the file handle back, and then you rename that thing. Compounding is another difference. SMB1 had a notion of and x, which meant do this thing and then do this other thing. Very few clients used it. SMB2 makes more use of it. We haven't seen it much yet from the Microsoft clients. Win7 allegedly does it even more. I actually expect them to use it even more, though, because they cleaned up basically all the rules associated with compounding. But so you'll actually see these long chains of things that make some of that handle-based stuff a little easier to deal with. So as an example, they didn't add a simple path-based stat call. So in order to do a stat, you have to open the file, query the info, close the file. But now you can just compound those into one packet. And there are ways in the compound to say, there's special handles, essentially, to say, just use the handle that was a result of the previous thing and feed it into me. There's this notion of credit-based pipelining for in-flight packets. So the server will grant a number of credits to the client, and that is the number of packets that client can have in flight at any given time. It's meant so the server can actually balance multiple connections at once and choke some of them if it needs to, or allow some to go through as it needs. SMB2 also added significantly larger buffer sizes. SMB was limited at around 64K. They weren't finished yet, so Win7 introduced SMB2.1, Win7 and 2K8R2. They changed opportunistic lock semantics a bit, added resilient file handles. The semantics for failover are actually a lot more clean now. So, it's kind of the whirlwind overview. What I want to do now is kind of dive down into some of the protocol details and give it to you from a perspective of difference from POSIX. So some of you may be wondering, if you just look at the packet captures, it kind of looks like a frilly version of NFS. But there are a lot of differences. Okay, the first major difference was the Windows security model. In both the Kerberos and NTLM authentication cases, the server gets a privilege attribute certificate as part of the authentication. I don't know if any of y'all paid attention to all the hubbub about Active Directory when it first came out and Microsoft extending Kerberos, yada, yada. This is part of that. The pack rolls up a lot of information about the user and group membership for said user. And what they did was extend to the Kerberos protocol, so that was actually just part of the ticket granting process. They did it because the pack ends up just signed by the account manager. In the Windows case, that is the Active Directory controller itself. The Unix world doesn't really do this. You can have Kerberos and LDAP, but they're two separate sources. It's just kind of a different model. The other major difference with the pack is that it contains Windows Security Identifier, which is SIDs, not UIDs and GIDs. SIDs are arbitrary length globally unique IDs. They're meant to apply throughout your domain. It's composed of a domain SID, further composed of a domain SID and a relative identifier. So as a gobbledygook example, this long string is a SID. It usually gets represented in binary form and not, you'll see it in text all the time, but obviously on the wire it's represented in binary. That 1013 is the RID, the relative ID. The thing before it is actually what's called the domain SID, and usually represents, like in an Active Directory domain, this would be, in essence, identifier 1013 in this domain. But you also might have local user accounts on the machine. Those machines will have machine SIDs, and then the local accounts will actually get assigned RIDs off of that. The other weird thing, and it doesn't matter as much during authentication as it does during some other operations like ACLs, is that SIDs are not typed. A given SID is just an identifier for an object. It can represent either a user or a group. So in Unix, we usually handle this a little differently. The full identity of the client is never really signed by the account manager. UIDs and GIDs are not globally unique. You might have some solution that tries to unify them, but I think plenty of you know the pains of actually unifying multiple groups of these. One advantage is UIDs and GIDs are small. Most Unix SMB solutions usually try to map from the SID to a UID or GID. This is actually kind of fraught with peril. As an example, if you try to deploy a Unix-based solution that does this in a infrastructure that has no central mapping from a username to a UID, GID, typically solutions will either auto-assign a UID, GID for that user, or they will use a hash of the SID. If they try to auto-assign, the chances that the auto-assign on one server actually match the auto-assign on another is very low. So things like if you had a Unix system and wanted to rsync between them, you would actually need to make sure that the SIDs were being assigned from the same place. Hash-based solutions tend to work a little better, but have hash collision issues. The other major issue is that when you're dealing with something like ACLs, you don't know whether it's a UID, whether it should be represented as a UID or as a GID. And that actually results in an extra round trip back to the directory server or whoever holds the account, because now you have this SID, and you're like, well, I don't know whether to assign him a UID or assign him a GID. So you have to go ask the domain controller, and this is an expensive process and can fail, because the domain controller, you may end up with just a SID in your ACL that has no relation to your domain. Like someone might have accidentally had a machine account SID or machine SID in there that isn't really relevant, but they're trying to set that ACL anyways. Another major difference is how SMB handles opens. In a way, the SMB open is similar to the POSIX open call, but has a lot more fine-grained details. So a file is opened with a desired file access. That access is similar to saying, oh, read, oh, write, et cetera, but it's much finer grained. It actually, you can say, I'm opening it to read the attributes only. I'm, opening it only to read the ACL even. There's an entire mask of these desired file accesses. There is another notion associated with the open, which is what kind of sharing is allowed. I'll get to that in just a second. And then there's what's called an opportunistic lock request. So sharing. The share mode can actually be thought of as a roughly inverse to a fine-grained whole file lock on the file. So you can say it's a bit mask of I'm sharing for read, I'm sharing for write, I'm sharing for delete. So you can say things like share for read write, but not delete. There's not a great equivalent for this on Unix. You have full file locks that are close, but they're usually advisory. I think the only right way to represent this in Unix is actually to fail opens, which we don't typically do for these scenarios. And none of the solutions I know have the notion of locking it for delete, or preventing other people from deleting. This is another piece that's actually required for NFSv4 interop. And at least in FreeBSD, the existing v4 server only handles this in memory, so it'll detect situations. It'll stay consistent if everyone is coming in through NFSv4, but again, does not detect it if someone is coming in via local file access or SMB or something like that. The other part of the open is an opportunistic lock request. Uplocks are the right for the client to cache data. They're requested at open time. In the Windows world, they have some rather odd names, but the most exclusive is a batch oplock, where the client can cache all writes, and the client can even cache all opens. So the client can open a file with a batch oplock and never have to send an open over the wire again. Another example is an exclusive oplock, where the client may cache writes, but has to actually send all opens over the wire. In practice, Windows clients never ask for exclusive oplocks. They only ever ask for batch. And then they have what's referred to as a level 2, which is really just a shared oplock, and the client can only keep a read-only cache. So oplocks are actually handled through a complicated means of you ask for the oplock. If it can be granted, the server will give it. Whenever the server needs the file back, like someone else is trying to open it, it will send what's referred to as an oplock break. In NFSv4 terms, this is a delegation, and this is a delegation revocation. Once that break comes through, the client has a set amount of time to flush all of his changes. After which the server usually times out on the break and gives the file to someone else. So this is not a complete cache coherency protocol, because you can see there is a window where if the client can't actually get all of its stuff out, there might end up being a small race while clients clobber each other. Again, there's no real Unix equivalent. There are some attempts. There are actually other file systems that have implemented stuff like this. I was talking to Robert about this, and AFS and others have implemented similar concepts. Linux actually has an inadequate lease interface that can handle some of this. And again, I'm not entirely familiar with their interface enough to go into details there. But again, this is a required for NFSv4 interop. The FreeBSD server currently only handles this in memory and does not interoperate with any other piece of the system. SMB has a notion of byte range locks. You thought you knew what these were too. Byte range locks in SMB are mandatory, unlike POSIX. Several Unixes have actually tried to implement this way as well, but I'll get to that in a second. Under SMB, read and write requests just fail if the region is locked. They don't time out, or they don't sit there waiting for the region to come back. They just come back as, sorry, it's locked. Because it's been in the protocol so long, things actually expect this. So if an application is doing byte range locks, it knows to expect failures if it just tries to write without the lock. There is no SMB notion of advisory locks. Oh, I forgot the Unix-like slide. So, okay. Like I said, I worked on AX previously. I know AX had mandatory locks. I don't know how they handled the contention case. Other Unixes have certainly tried to implement it as well. This one is actually an interesting interop issue because it's unclear in a POSIX world what we should do when someone has an SMB byte range lock on the file, whether just to ignore it, to fail the write, to wait for it. Some of those may have workflow issues with POSIX applications that aren't expecting errors. I don't have a great solution there. It actually is a little clearer what to do with advisory locks versus SMB mandatory locks. There you actually have the option of waiting or failing them. But, yeah. SMB also supports a notion called change notify. This allows registration for listeners on a single file, a directory but no subdirectories, or an entire directory tree and everything under it. As a note, change notify is usually considered advisory. It's not meant to be a mechanism to keep your metadata cache up to date. It's more meant to be a UI presentation mechanism so you can do things like update your Explorer window. Change notify is not audit, for instance. We have single file, single directory level notification present in FreeBSD and a variety of other OSs. No one that I know actually implements recursive notification. I might be wrong here. We do, but it's a hard problem. Single directory notification is present in NFSv4.1, but it's more for metadata caching, and it's called directory delegations. Another interesting detail that various Unix variants have tried to adopt as well is the notion of alternate data streams. Actually, if you want the real history, it probably goes back to Mac with resource forks, but the NTFS alternate data streams are full substreams within a file, but they don't contain separate metadata. So they're just data, no metadata, no ACLs, no nothing. You just have what's referred to as the default stream and then name streams off of that. They get used a variety of places in Windows. If you right-click and look at properties on a document, for instance, and try setting some of that stuff, a lot of that is kept in alternate data streams. Various Unix variants have something close, but no one seems to have done it exactly right. Apparently Solaris allows setting ACLs on the separate streams, which isn't right. NTFS also has a security descriptor. NTFS has no mode bits. It is just the security descriptor. The security descriptor contains the owner. I forgot to list that. But it also contains something called the SACL and the DACL. The SACL is the system access control list, and it describes how a file should be audited. It has a similar format to an ACL. The DACL is the discretionary access control list and describes who is authorized. So that's usually what we refer to as ACLs. If you're familiar with NFSv4 ACLs, they were based on NTFS ACLs, but there's many subtle distinctions. Mode bit interaction in NFSv4 ACLs is underspecified and needs to be standardized heavily between vendors. Solaris does it one way. We do it slightly differently from Solaris. OXX does it slightly differently, et cetera. Windows admins rarely use deny aces. The Unix versions are replete with them. NTFS has a canonical order, even though the ACLs are allowed to be specified in any order. Windows generally expects them to be deny first, allow last. The last little niggling detail for SMB, NTFS is case insensitive. This is negotiable in SMB, but in practice you want to stay insensitive to interoperate with any Windows apps. There's no standard way to approach this in Unix. We have a case insensitive lookup variant. I think Solaris does something else. We also recently discovered that that wasn't sufficient, and there are situations where even with a case-insensitive lookup, we have to know the canonical name on the disk. So we have something we just called estat to give it a file name, or a case-insensitive file name, give us the canonical file name back. So wrapping up, sorry, I'm a little late here. SMB is not going to go away. There are plenty of shops out there still using Windows. And if you want to try to replace their Windows servers without disrupting their workflow, interop is the key. We've been getting closer and closer over the years, but there are many things that are still not perfect. A lot of Windows apps rely on a lot of features of NTFS because they know they're there, and SIFS just SMB just blindly supports almost all of them. So most Windows apps going over SMB don't even notice they're not on NTFS. Because of that, interop with all of the features, op locks, share mode locks, etc., is very necessary. In a lot of cases, there are no right answers. There are just some less wrong ones. I don't know how to handle mode bits and ACLs. I don't know how to handle some of the identity management issues with SIDs. But I'm hoping we can come up with some, like down the road, various vendors can say, okay, this is how we should interoperate in this world. All right, I have some time for questions. Go ahead. What is the policy for sharing and pushing? So at Isilon we use Samba. All of our Samba changes are public. They're in fact checked into the global Samba tree. We are moving away from Samba, as I mentioned yesterday, but we have several kernel level changes, most of which have not been upstreamed yet. So a lot of this is stuff that, some of this is actually stuff that we haven't yet figured out how we want to give back to the community, and that's the main reason we haven't made any of it public. We support a lot of these features internally. Did that answer your question? What was it? Yes. Right. Right. What are the major changes for interop with Windows?
Challenges.
Well, I just listed a lot of them. Did you? did you have a more specific question? Like, there are. And it's a very broad question. challenges to interoperate with Windows, there are a lot of pieces of the protocol, and there are, for us it's just fairly different than Unix. So that's created a lot of challenges for us. For a while, up until about a year ago, some of it was, hey, we don't actually know everything about this protocol yet. So there it was, the openness issue. Given that we've had, given that we have a more open Microsoft now, that hurdle is being overcome. From there, it's just a matter of getting code in. So I don't know. Did that help? Yes. The question was, do we get a good result if we get a challenge, if we have a challenge with the protocol documentation? Yeah, they've actually been very responsive. There's a SIFS protocol mailing list, and then there's a documentation bug alias at Microsoft. And if you mail those, they'll email you back very rapidly saying, hey, we're looking at it. And then their turnaround times vary between a day and a couple of weeks, depending on how long the issue is. I actually did it a couple times. And one was user error on my part. The other was they responded too rapidly and said, oh, yeah, that error code is documented in the next revision, you know, stuff like that. Any other questions? The question was, what about performance? For Samba, we use a send file, receive file. We have a private receive file implementation. So we have various hacks to do zero copy in the kernel. So we'll take it straight off of the socket and slap it into the file, or vice versa. That was one of the major things we did for SMB. Other than that, Samba itself is very syscall chatty. We tried to reduce that. Performance over SIFS. There are other vendors that get, as far as single stream performance, actually get near NFS speeds over SMB. So it is not a huge issue. Namespace performance is tricky to measure because they're kind of different protocols. So I think there was one more question, and then I probably have to cede the floor here. The question was something about, with XP, you never had to enter your username and password. With Vista, you're having trouble. I probably couldn't answer that without looking at packet captures very easily, but it could be an NTLM issue of some sort. It could be Vista rejecting. It could be that Vista is sending over cache credentials that Samba is rejecting, something like that. Right. I mean, one of the differences is Vista switched to NTLM v2 by default. Whereas XP, unless you did a registry tweak, would do NTL MV2 only when requested. So there's some subtle differences there. All right, I think I'm over time. Thank you.